From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, elected officials using campaign funds to pay credit card bills. How do we know what's personal and what's political spending?
A lot of it really is on the honor system.
Investigating paranormal activity, slamming doors, voices, footsteps, and more.
Cases with children, a lot of the times, are they have an imaginary friend that may not be quite as imaginary as they think.
How sheep are helping in the fight against Huntington's disease.
These little lambs that maybe weigh 80 to 100 pounds produce just an abundance of this GM1 gangliocyte.
Ojibwe brothers from Sault Ste. Marie tell their tribal stories in their new film, Inatase.
One of the things we were really conscious of and set out to do when we made the film was how to make an inherently Ojibwe film.
Those stories and more for you today on Stateside. Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, how do we know what's personal and what is political spending? A state lawmaker faces questions about how he has been spending campaign donations.
You know, we should be able to see whether the expenditure is a legitimate office holder expense or whether it is something else. And in many, many cases, and it's impossible to make that determination from what's on the public record.
And then Huntington's disease.
It's a genetic dominant disease. So if your parent has Huntington's disease, there's a 50% chance that each of the children will have Huntington's disease.
We're going to hear about a treatment using sheep that could bring hope to patients and their families. But first, they've been described as obnoxious, counterproductive, and that is from the former lawmaker who helped to pass legislation authorizing Michigan's driver responsibility fees. Well, now the Michigan District Judges Association has weighed in against the fees. The judges have sent a letter to Governor Snyder asking him to get rid of these fees, which they call an outrageous burden on the backs of Michigan's working class. One of those critics, a longtime critic, is Judge William Kelly. He is on the bench of the 62B District Court in Kentwood and is with us now. Judge William Kelly, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you very much for letting me participate.
Before we get into your thoughts about these driver responsibility fees, let's get us all on the same page. Tell us what they are and why they're levied.
Well, in 2003, the state was facing an enormous deficit, and they either had to make some drastic cuts or come up with some more revenue. They didn't want to raise taxes, and so they came up with a scheme called the driver responsibility fee, which penalizes drivers convicted of certain offenses twice. They have to pay the fines and costs in the court, and then they have to turn around and pay another fee to the state of Michigan. These fees were levied on various offenses. For example, driving while suspended or operating while visibly impaired was $500 a year for 2 years. Reckless driving was $500. Failure to stop at the scene of a property damage accident. Maximum fine, $100, but it was a $1,000 driver responsibility fee for 2 years. Operating while intoxicated, $1,000 a year for 2 years.
If I'm standing before you and you're levying this fee, if you're telling me for the next couple of years I have to pay an extra $1,000, that can really blow a hole in somebody's wallet.
Exactly. So some people would have the money and they would pay it so they could keep their driver's license. They would certainly grumble, and the legislatures heard those people grumble and complain. But if you don't have the money, you don't have the money, and so they end up with their license being suspended. Then if they drive to work and they get picked up for driving on a suspended license, they have to pay another $500 a year for 2 years.
And we should point out these fees are on top of whatever it is that you might have imposed as far as punishment for whatever they did.
Exactly, because this is part of a double punishment. Now, in 2014, Representative Joe Haveman was the primary sponsor of a bill which would phase out the driver responsibility fee. And the bill was passed by the House 108-0 to not assess the fee after October 1st, 2017, this month. But we got over to the Senate and we had to compromise. And so the bills at this point, they're only being charged for 1 year instead of 2 years. And they're going to be continued to be assessed until October 1st of 2019, after which point they will no longer be assessed. But at this point, over 300,000 Michiganders, that's 4% of the licensed drivers, owe $632 million in driver responsibility fees.
That's a big, big bunch of money.
Now, it would be one thing if the state were going to see that $632 million, but they're never going to see most of it because you either pay it when you have it or when it's first assessed, or you don't pay it. And the people who don't pay it are the poor people, and this is really a burden on poor people here in the state of Michigan.
What are you seeing? Give us an idea of what you see every day in your courtroom, Judge Kelly, that makes you join with the Michigan District Judges Association in saying these are such a bad idea with devastating negative effects.
Every week, we have many people coming before the court for driving on a suspended license. In the month of September, 82 people were scheduled to appear in the 62B District Court in Kentwood for driving while suspended. Of those, 37, that's 45% of them, owed 176 driver responsibility fees. And eight of those 37 people had had their license suspended for more than 5 years for failure to pay a driver responsibility fee. And only 21, that's about a quarter, of these people who were scheduled to appear before me for driving while suspended were suspended for bad driving, unsatisfactory driving record, drunk driving, or reckless driving, or revocation of a license. We're inundated with people who are charged with driving on a suspended license. It's not that they're bad drivers, it's that they're poor, financially poor drivers.
How do these fees impact their lives?
They impact their lives in that they are not able to get to work. In fact, in the city of Detroit, the mayor set up a Detroit workforce development with representatives of 40 of the largest employers in Detroit. They said the number one problem was that they weren't able to get the transcripts from people who graduated from Detroit high schools for weeks or months. And so they are going out and digitizing all of those transcript records so that they are available promptly. The second biggest problem was that people couldn't get to work because of these driver responsibility fees. So employers are going out and saying, we would love to hire you, but you can't get here. So employers are missing out on good employees.
Now, there were bills, Judge, that, as you say, were introduced in both the State House and Senate. They would have gotten rid of these DRFs, but they've been held up because the Treasury Department had concerns about the budget. These fees generated $69.2 million in revenues for the state in the last fiscal year and expected to generate about $52 million in revenue for the state in this fiscal year. So what about this budget hole?
If these bills were to go through as introduced, it would reduce the revenue to the state of Michigan by about $30 million. In my opinion, it was a real shame that they plugged the deficit hole back in 2003 with the driver responsibility fee. But desperate times lead to desperate measures. But today, in 2017, our economy is much better. The state budget is in much better shape. It's, I think, a greater shame that we're still relying on these driver responsibility fees on the back of the poor people, the people who are least able to afford it.
Now, the state Senate has proposed eliminating fees over 6 years old, but keeping them in place for any fees assessed within 6 years. Would that be a good compromise in your view?
Not really, because the Treasury Department doesn't collect any fees that are over 6 years old currently. And they want to continue assessing these fees until 2019. So really, the Senate bill, as passed in the Senate, would keep the status quo. And it's really time for us to get rid of these fees once and for all.
So the point of the letter that the Michigan District Judges Association wrote to Governor Snyder last week is to present the opposition that Michigan's judges feel. What would a fair solution be in your mind?
The hole that we're talking about is $30 million out of a $10 billion budget. That's a very, very small percentage. I think it works out to be, what, 0.3% of the general fund budget. And I think that they can find some savings somewhere. Earlier this year, the House of Representatives, 52 of the representatives, voted to reduce the state income tax by 0.1%, which would have reduced the revenue by $195 million. This bill would be a drop in the bucket compared to $195 million deficit or hole.
And when you consider what you're seeing with the people in front of you in your courtroom every day and the hardship this causes, I can tell that you're saying this is way out of whack.
Way out of whack is a very good way of describing it.
Judge Kelly, you've been kind of at the forefront of judicial opposition against these fees. How long have you been trying to raise the alarm about these fees?
Since they were imposed. And I've testified before the House of Representatives and Senate back in about 2006 or 2009. So it's been a long time opposition because we in the district court bench see people coming in before us on traffic offenses all the time and are burdened by these fees. sometimes the people get charged with these fees and they didn't even know that they were going to have these fees because nobody told them that if you plead guilty to driving while suspended, you have to pay fines and costs and a $500 driver responsibility fee this year and a $500 driver responsibility fee next year. A lot of people would go out and pay the driver responsibility fee thinking that that took care of their obligations, and they didn't pay the court's fines and costs, or vice versa. And when they didn't pay one or the other, they ended up with a suspended license. So it became very complicated for the people who are burdened with these fees.
What kind of response did you get when you would try to raise your concerns with these?
Well, the judges unanimously support abolishing these fees. And the legislators would say, yeah, we know it's a bad idea, but we need the money. Everybody knows it's a bad fee.
Judge William Kelly, we want to thank you so much for talking with us today on Stateside.
Well, thank you.
A direct invitation from me to you. Please come join the Stateside team and me this coming Thursday because we're doing a live show in East Lansing. We'll have a conversation with longtime Lansing Mayor Virge Bonero. We'll feature a Lansing area artisan. And we're going to discover why the Mid-Michigan region is a landing spot for refugees from all around the world. You can catch that and so much more by joining us this Thursday, November 2nd. We'll be at the Kellogg Center on the campus of the Michigan State University, and the show starts at 7 p.m. We'd love to see you in the audience. Details are at michiganradio.org. Coming up, two brothers from the Ojibwe tribe in Sault Ste. Marie tell tribal stories in their new film, Inatase.
We were really conscious of the way people have tried to approach our community before, and we wanted to be really conscious of not doing that.
That comes up in 20 minutes, right here on Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Cynthia Canty. It's against the law in our state for anyone who holds political office to use campaign funds to pay personal expenses. But it can be tricky to figure out if this is happening when elected officials use campaign money to pay off credit cards and go skimpy on the details. Such is the case with Lake Orion Republican State Senator Jim Marlowe, as outlined in a front-page story by Detroit Free Press reporter Paul Egan. Paul, what did you find with Senator Marlowe, his credit card and campaign donations?
He is an outlier in the Michigan legislature. He's term limited, so he has no election to spend money on in terms of advertising or anything like that. He gets a lot of donations. He's on some important committees. He spends a lot of money, and he charges his credit card bills to his campaign committee and gives very little detail. Since he became a senator, he's charged about $114,000 in credit card bills to his campaign fund, and of that amount, about $65,000 was unitemized. And even where the charges are itemized, it can be very general, you know, a one-word comment like supplies, for example.
And he is his own campaign treasurer. Is that common?
It's not uncommon. I'd say most state senators probably have an outside person as a treasurer, but it's not uncommon for people in both the House and the Senate to act as their own treasurer.
What kind of charges are we talking about?
Well, that's, Cynthia, where I almost hate to pick on Senator Marlowe in a way, but what he did was he gave us a rare view of the actual credit card statements behind these charges. The Secretary of State election officials had been challenging him on his lack of specificity, his lack of detailing of what these charges are. And at some point, he sent in, I'm not sure if he expected them to be posted online as they were, but he sent in 12 of his actual credit card statements, and he annotated them, kind of scribbled after each charge, you know, this is what this was, this is what that was. That did actually get the Secretary of State office back, but when I looked at these statements, it certainly raised a lot more questions for me. You know, for example, there was a charge, I think about $138 at Kohl's, and he had annotated that with the words shirts in campaign yellow. Again, he doesn't have a campaign coming up. He's not allowed really to charge any campaign-related charges. He can charge what they call expenses incidental to holding office. But there were well over $1,000 in restaurant charges. And again, if you're holding a meeting with someone about state business, that can be a legitimate charge. But what was interesting, there were 15 charges of exactly $25 at a variety of fast food restaurants, McDonald's, Panera. You know, I don't think I've ever once had a bill that came out exactly to $25. It certainly looked like the purchase of gift cards, which kind of raises questions about how that would be a legitimate expense. Unfortunately, the other thing was we made every effort, including, you know, dropping by to see him and submitting written questions by email. And Senator Marlowe just absolutely declined to talk to us about the details of these charges.
So there it was in your front page story. And when you talk to campaign finance watchdog groups, Paul Degan, what do they have to say about this?
A couple of things. One is that historically, where most of the scrutiny has been seen on these reports is on the donation side. We've paid a lot of attention to who's giving money and what, you know, what might they be getting in return. And increasingly, there is a lot more focus coming to this expenditure side. And really, a lot of it really is on the honor system. And, you know, and most public office holders are probably honorable people. But it does seem like there should be some checks and balances. And you know, the whole idea really that campaign finance experts and many members of the public would just like to see is transparency. You know, we should be able to see whether the expenditure is a legitimate office holder expense or whether it is something else. And in many, many cases, and it's impossible to make that determination from what's on the public record.
Anyone raise the observation that perhaps this is an interesting byproduct of term limits?
I hadn't heard that one, but how so?
Well, as you were saying, there's nothing left to spend this on, and there's no more worry about being reelected. You wonder if that leads to a devil takes the details attitude, particularly when they're on the honor system and it seems that state oversight's fairly lax.
I think that is a good point, and that's one of the interesting things we see is term-limited lawmakers continuing to hold fundraisers and raise money when they have no pending campaign. And so, you know, then it becomes a question of where does this money go?
Interesting read. Go to freep.com and you'll find Paul Egan's front page story, Lawmaker Credit Card Reimbursements Raise Questions About Political Versus Personal Spending. Paul Egan, always great talking with you. Thanks so much.
You too, Cynthia. Thanks.
There is absolutely no way to sugarcoat a diagnosis of Huntington's disease. This nerve disease cannot be cured, and as it progresses, it causes mental illness and a host of physical symptoms. And the patient always knows they have Huntington's disease and they will die from it. One promising front in the war on this disease, sheep. With us now are two of the Michigan-based farmers and researchers who are searching for a way to treat Huntington's disease. Dr. Heather Ludlam is a veterinarian and a sheep farmer from Hopkins. Hello, Heather.
Hello.
Great to have you here. And Gary Dunbar is with us, a professor of neuroscience and experimental psychology at Central Michigan University, with us via Skype. Hi, Gary.
Hi.
Let's start with Huntington's disease itself. It's genetic. It famously claimed folk singer Woody Guthrie. And Heather, you've seen it firsthand in your family, haven't you?
Yes, I have. My husband, Mike, was adopted as a child, and his older sister, Dory, was also adopted. And they were adopted in the 1960s. They were all closed adoptions. No one received any medical information or medical history, you know, when the children were adopted. And Mike's sister, Dory, was diagnosed very late in life as an adult with Huntington's disease.
And what kinds of symptoms did you watch your sister-in-law endure?
It was terrible. My sister-in-law was an amazing person, extremely bright, talented businesswoman, kind of just had the world by the tail. And When she was in her early to mid-30s, after she had her first two children, she just started to decline mentally. And at first we wrote it off to postpartum depression or staying home with the kids, but it became very severe. You know, it went from minor family drama to violent outbursts. And finally, she started having some physical trouble, twitches and facial tics. And my husband, Mike, was a conservation officer. He was a police officer at the time, and he asked her straight out if she was doing drugs because he thought, my gosh, I think maybe she's an addict, the way she's acting and these physical signs that she has. And she said, no, Mike, I'm not doing anything. And he said, well, then you have to start taking care of yourself. You have to go to a doctor. And she saw a doctor, you know, within a couple weeks, and he looked right at her and said, oh, I think you have Huntington's disease. And we knew nothing about Huntington's disease at this time. We had no idea it was a genetic disease. It's a genetic dominant disease. So if your parent has Huntington's disease, there's a 50% chance that each of the children will have Huntington's disease. And that's just with one parent having it. Hmm. So it immediately, you know, affected Dory's entire family. She had three children at that point.
Unbelievable, and no cure. And that's why any glimmer of hope is so worth looking at. And that's why we turn to this molecule that could treat, maybe even reverse the effects of Huntington's. And that molecule is named GM1 ganglioside, GM1 for short. Gary, what is it? What is GM1? Where does it come from?
Well, GM1 is a molecule we call it a glycosphingolipid, which basically means it's sort of a sugar fatty molecule. But it's found in the outer leaflet, the outer portion of every cell membrane. And it's found in high concentrations, particularly in neuronal membranes.
And where are those?
Those are on the neurons, surrounding all the neurons and glial cells in the brain. But too much of that can be harmful, and having too little of the GM1 gangliosides may be detrimental. And we know in Huntington's disease, for instance, GM1 gangliosides is downregulated. There's too little of it in those cells.
So they're deficient. And what happens when patients get a treatment of a compound that contains GM1 ganglioside?
Well, we don't know exactly what's going to happen with the human patients with Huntington's disease. It hasn't been thoroughly studied. It's safe because they have studied it in Parkinson's disease. They have seen some improvements in some of the patients, but it's not a cure-all in and of itself for Parkinson's disease.
But it's a promising avenue to explore. But here's the thing, you can't make synthetic GM1, which is why we're turning to sheep. Heather, what is it sheep can do in this quest for GM1 ganglioside?
Well, these sheep kind of got into this story sideways as sheep producers. But having a history of Huntington's in the family, we lost Mike's sister at the age of 51. She passed, and that was back in 2012. And after going through Huntington's disease, it's just, you know, such an ordeal. We kind of took a break from Huntington's. The kids were young. Dory's children were young. And we figured we had some time before we had to worry about them becoming symptomatic. And we took a break. But in 2015... Mike was looking at the American sheep industry news online, and they had a little one-paragraph blurb about these sheep in South Dakota that may have a neurologic disease, and it may be a promising treatment for Huntington's disease. And he forwarded it to me and said, you're the veterinarian, investigate this. And I read it, and I thought, well, I don't know if there's anything to this. This could just be another animal model. And I kind of blew it off for a little while. But the same little announcement kept showing up in all our sheep publications, you know, so over the next couple of weeks. So I contacted the veterinarian who basically developed this line of sheep, Dr. Larry Holler at South Dakota State University. He's a veterinary pathologist. And I basically bugged him with calls and emails for about 2 days straight. But what he explained to me, and so what we found, is he developed these sheep. They were his PhD research project, and they have a disease called GM1 gangliosidosis. And these sheep lack an enzyme that breaks down the GM1 ganglioside. Normally, we all have GM1 ganglioside, you know, in our nervous tissues and some of our other tissues. But there's an enzyme that breaks it down, helps it recycle so we don't get too much buildup. These sheep that Dr. Holler figured out their genetics and has been breeding for over 20 years, they lack that enzyme. They don't break down the GM1, so
they produce 40 times the normal amount of GM1 in their brain, spinal cord, and some of their other organs and tissues, 40 times more than we could get from, say, one cow brain or, you know, some other animal brain. So these little lambs that maybe weigh 80 to 100 pounds produce just an abundance of this GM1 gangliocyte. So Dr. Howler, very slowly over many years, kind of figured out my sheep could help people. And he just has very slowly over the years, while working full-time and farming full-time, developed these sheep, worked out a genetic test for the GM1 gangliosidosis, worked with a company in Alabama to extract the GM1 and get it into research-grade form. So very slowly this project has been developing over the years. He worked with a Parkinson's group for a little while. Some Huntington's researchers did some pretty compelling research in mice with GM1 gangliocyte in 2012. And found that it could, you know, basically reverse the symptoms of Huntington's disease in mice using the GM1. So that's kind of how the sheep started tying in. That's when Dr. Howler realized that, you know, these sheep could help Huntington's patients. And, you know, like us, these Huntington's families, you know, back in 2003 when Mike's sister was diagnosed, we were given zero hope. You know, there were no clinical trials at the time. Nothing was going on, and it was so frustrating because really all we could do was just try to make her last couple of years as comfortable as possible and watch her pass, you know. So now with these sheep, we have the ability to actually do something that we do normally. We raise sheep, so it's pretty amazing that we're able to help, you know, try to help now.
Gary, is it fair to compare the promise of GM1 gangliocyte for these genetic neurological diseases like Huntington's disease or perhaps Parkinson's and Alzheimer's? Could we compare that, or at least the promise of it, with insulin for diabetes?
Wow, that's a tough comparison. I'm not sure that would hold. I know a lot about GM1 gangliocyte. I started working with it in 1983 as a graduate student in Don Stein's lab at Clark University in Worcester, Massachusetts. There we found, and we were using just a simple animal model of brain damage. We did some Parkinson models, and they were fairly crude models back then. But we did see some very promising results with the GM1 gangliocyte. We tried that by lesioning an area of the brain called the neostriatum, which is the area of the brain that degenerates in Huntington's disease. Sure enough, when we tried the GM1, it had remarkable benefits for the animals that were given the GM1. Did it cure them? No. Did it reduce the deficits significantly? Yes, it did. And that was very promising.
Heather, how far along is awareness in the nation's sheep-raising community about the fact that you could introduce this recessive gene into a flock and you could raise sheep with GM1 gangliosidosis so you can help this research?
Actually, the sheep industry is becoming very aware of it just recently over probably the last 2 years. And the sheep industry has been, like, amazingly supportive. We invited the Howlers to come to our Michigan Shepherds Weekend, January of 2016, so it would have been last year, as guest speakers to talk about the project. We have a super strong sheep industry in Michigan. You know, we don't have the largest sheep numbers, but we have probably one of the largest number of producers, and we have one of the most diverse sheep industries in the country in Michigan, and extremely progressive people, progressive producers. So really supportive, and a lot of producers are aware of it and would like to get involved. Basically, the Howlers are trying not to put the cart before the horse. They don't want to have too many sheep producers signed up until there's a market for the product, or at least it's getting into clinical trials in humans.
And there's the question, Gary, how far are we, do you think, from clinical trials with humans?
Oh, I don't think it's too far away at all, particularly since we know GM1 gangliocyte is safe and safe in humans. So the phase one should be very, very quick. And I think the steps that Dr. Howler, when I talked to him, mentioned that need to be taken before we pursue that is, one, we want to make sure that the ovine source, the sheep source, works as well as the bovine or cow source of the gangliocyte. You know, we need to try this not only in cell cultures, but also in our animal models. And we have more sophisticated models of Huntington's disease now than we ever had before. So we can give a very good, thorough testing of the efficacy of this and match My guess is it's going to work every bit as well. And I don't think it's going to take too long to prove that. And if we prove it's safe, at least in the animals, then phase one trials probably would go very quickly because we know the bovine source was safe. And I would presume that the sheep source would be equally as safe. I can see this being in clinical trials in the next 5 years easily.
Well, it will be fascinating to watch the progress as the sheep farming community works with scientists to come up with some kind of a weapon in the war on Huntington's disease. And we want to thank you for sharing your work with us. We've been talking with Gary Dunbar, professor of neuroscience and experimental psychology at Central Michigan University, and Heather Ludlam, Dr. Heather Ludlam, a veterinarian and a sheep farmer from Hopkins, Michigan. Thanks to both of you for sharing your work with us.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for having me as well.
Coming up after the break, investigating paranormal activities, slamming doors, footsteps, mystery voices, and more. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The Ojibwe people have a long, proud history in Michigan. A new documentary film from brothers Adam and Zach Khalil tell the stories of the Ojibwe tribe in their hometown of Sault Ste. Marie, using the ancient Seven Fires prophecy to explore modern Ojibwe culture and its challenges.
The fourth fire was originally given to the people by two prophets. One of the prophets said, "You will know the future of our people by what face the light-skinned race wears. If they come wearing the face of brotherhood, then there will come a time of wonderful change for generations to come. In this way, two mighty nations will join to make one."
And filmmaker Adam Khalil is here with us now. Adam, welcome to Stateside. It's so great to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
Now, since I want to do justice to the title of your film, and it's a combination of Ojibwe and English, would you say it for us?
Yeah, it's a really easy title to remember. It's a not to say. It shines a certain way to a certain place. It flies, it falls. Super easy to remember.
Yeah.
Super Googleable.
And yeah. And what do those words, is that it shines a certain way to a certain place, it flies, falls? Is that what in not to say means?
That's the translation. But what it really means is a movie, which is a really original title, too. So and not to say means a movie, but there's a thinking in Anishinaabe linguistics that each syllable is actually a verb. So when you break down and not to say into the specific syllables that then become verbs, it translates into it shines a certain way to a certain place. It flies, it falls. And for me and my brother, that has two meanings. One is that's like the film apparatus or how people watch films. It shines a certain way to a certain place is the projector, the light hitting the screen, and then it flies, it falls is representative of the film going through the projector when it was film and falling out to the other side. But it also has a more personal meaning to us because it shines a certain way to a certain place is our home, Bawating or Sault Ste. Marie. And then it flies, it falls was kind of indicative of the somewhat chaotic nature in which the film came together.
And why is that? Why was it chaotic?
There's been like a long history of people coming into our communities trying to extract information or knowledge, and we're really conscious of that. Like the history of documentary, it's like one of the first recorded images ever made is Thomas Edison's Sioux Ghost Dance, where he basically bust in Indian people to perform in front of a camera because his camera was so large it couldn't leave his studio. And then also like Nanook of the North is like ostensibly the first documentary, but really it's like a piece of branded content for a French fur company. So we were really conscious of the way people have tried to approach our community before in this way where they wanted like sound bites or clips or some kind of knowledge. And we wanted to be really conscious of not doing that or mimicking that way of making films. So we went in a very open-ended approach and did like way too many interviews and like let people talk as opposed to dictating what they said.
So basically we get a chance to meet people from the Ojibwe tribe in Sault Ste. Marie who can tell their own stories, not someone else co-opting them.
Yeah, I mean, we did edit it. So, like, there is definitely some authorship that we did there, but we didn't want to make it so specific or closed off. People could share what they wanted to share as opposed to dictating what we needed from them, you know?
Mm. And you use this ancient Seven Fires prophecy as a sort of frame for your film. What is that?
Our tradition is an oral tradition, which means things are allowed to change and adapt. And the Seven Fires prophecy, as I've been told and as I've read about it, it kind of predates and predicts contact with Europeans. As I know it, the prophecy happened like 2,000 years ago, basically. So we knew what was going to happen before it happened.
Mm.
But the cool thing about the Seven Fires prophecy and the oral tradition is that it's allowed to adapt to the times. There's a Western conception of history, like Walter Benjamin talking about the angel of history always moving forward but looking backwards. That's a very European way of thinking about history. But an Ojibwe way of thinking about history is that history is a narrative that should be in service of the contemporary people at a contemporary time. So it kind of gave us artistic license to play with the story as well, and it was a great structure because of that, because we could have these kind of points that we had to hit. But getting to those points, we were allowed some artistic freedom and liberty to kind of tailor the story to the contemporary moment.
And to that point, your film is very, very impressionist. You use distorted sound effects and low-resolution video and layered images and animation. Very contemporary. Were you aiming this film at a specific audience who really gets impressionist modern approach?
One of the things we were really conscious of and set out to do when we made the film was how to make an inherently Ojibwe film. If you think about cinema in terms of a national lens, which is how it's understood in terms of cinema history, there's American cinema, there's Japanese cinema, there's French cinema, etc. So we were trying to figure out what would an inherently Ojibwe form of cinema look like. So as opposed to like using the kind of cliches or tropes of documentary from a settler colonial vantage point, what would our own authored story look like? So that gave us kind of carte blanche to kind of take all these different devices that we liked and not have to stick to fitting it into a specific mold. It allowed us a lot of freedom to try to tell our own tribe story in our own way.
And you've been taking your film out to audiences. What's the reaction been? What has struck you in audience reactions?
Well, it's been interesting. And maybe also to like riff on the last question also about audience is that one of the strengths of the film that I think is that we're communicating to many different audiences at the same time using the same film, right? So, like, I know for a fact that, like, Ojibwe audiences understand more of the film, or there's things that are kind of coded into the film that maybe a general audience wouldn't get necessarily. But we were also conscious of, like, not wanting to hermetically seal the film and allow other people, like a general audience, to still have it be approachable. So it's like thinking about cinema not only on a horizontal line, but also a vertical sense. So you could have these different conversations kind of layered on top of each other. And that kind of led to a lot of the layering in the film, even aesthetically.
That clip that we heard at the very beginning of our conversation, Adam, about the fourth fire prophecy that two mighty nations will join to make one. Is it your hope that your film will help fulfill that kind of by enlightening your audiences and helping whites to better understand Anishinaabe culture and society?
Yeah, I mean, I think the big thing is for as tribal people or as like indigenous people is the right to sovereignty and self-determination. And without those things, it's a really tough reality. And we've been kind of given sovereignty, but it's kind of like a kid version of sovereignty. Like we're not actually considered a nation state, which makes it really hard to self-determine or dictate what our own peoples do or have done, you know?
Mm.
It's a kind of paternalistic sovereignty that's, here, you can have a government, sure, but, like, don't get out of line. And that doesn't really work, you know, and has led to a lot of problems in our community and other tribal communities as well.
Now, how can people see your film, Inatase?
So, yeah, I've been touring it around for the past 5 weeks, and we'll be I'm going down to Minneapolis and St. Paul and going to show it all around Minnesota over the next 2 weeks. But, yeah, on our website, there's ways to access the film if you contact us.
We have put the link up for their website for you at the michiganradio.org site at the stateside page so you can access it and find out more. What future plans do you have? So you've got, this is your first feature-length film. What's ahead for you and your brother, Zach?
So we just received two grants, one from PBS and one from Sundance, to work on two new projects. And I'm actually in Thunder Bay, Ontario, right now doing research for the feature film that's being supported by Sundance, which is going to be a biopic, a narrative biopic about the Ojibwe painter Norvel Morisot, who for us is kind of like one of the main reasons we're making artwork. He was wildly successful in the 60s and 70s and was basically the first indigenous person to be exhibited as a contemporary artist and not inside of a museum as like as cultural objects, but actually art. And he painted these huge, huge canvases with really psychedelic colors, kind of taking the traditional stories but updating them into a contemporary form. And he also had a really crazy life.
So you've got a lot to work with this new film.
Oh, yeah. No, he's an amazing figure and very complicated. And there's a lot of paradoxes throughout his life, and there's a lot to chew on there. Thunder Bay was always a home base for him, so we're here now kind of doing research, meeting people who knew him, meeting with his family, making sure we're doing this in the right way, because it's a loaded story, and we want to make sure we're doing it right.
Filmmaker Adam Khalil, he and his brother Zach are out with their first feature-length film, Inatase. It shines a certain way to a certain place. It flies, it falls. And you can get information by going to their website, and the link is up for you at the stateside page at michiganradio.org. Good luck with the film, and especially with your upcoming project, Adam. It was great to talk with you.
Thanks so much for having me. Chi miigwech.
Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. It is Halloween, perfect time to talk about paranormal activity around our state, also known as hauntings. With us now is the founder of the Michigan Area Paranormal Investigative Team, Daniel Mackin. Welcome to the program on this Halloween.
Hello, thanks for having me on.
Daniel, when we say paranormal activity, exactly what are we talking about? What is it that you and your team track?
I'm basically paranormal defined is something outside of the realm of the normal. So basically, most of what we deal with is hauntings, things like that. But paranormal can cover a wide umbrella area of different things. It can cover UFOs. It can cover Bigfoot. I mean, there's a lot of crazy things that fall outside the realm of science. But our particular genre that we truly pursue is hauntings and paranormal activity in those environments.
So how much paranormal activity, when we talk about these hauntings, how much of that is going on in Michigan?
Surprisingly more probably than people think. You know, don't be too surprised, I guess, if your neighbor has a ghost story. We get called a lot. We generally probably do between 15 and 20 cases a year. And we kind of travel all around the northern Michigan area and a little bit beyond. So it's a pretty vast area. But, you know, sometimes you're going to go in and it's not going to amount to anything. You know, you may not catch anything. Maybe there isn't anything going on. But we do get a pretty high number. Usually if people get to that point where they're going to give us a call, they've got some serious issues going on.
Like what? What are some of the reasons somebody might call you and say, I want you to come to my house and check something out? What kind of calls do you get?
I think our first and foremost one, especially as far as private cases at residences, are people that are concerned about their children. And we put those as a really high priority case because we are here to help, basically. In general, cases with children, a lot of the times they have an imaginary friend that may not be quite as imaginary as they think. And for us, from our perspective, it seems that different entities, different sorts of spirits may latch on to children because they're a little more perceptive. Their young eyes may just see things a little bit differently than we do. They may be a little bit more susceptible to something that is kind of mentally looking for a way in to haunt an environment or a person.
Hmm. So somebody may call and say, my child insists there is, you know, someone they see at night or they have this imaginary friend. Might you also get calls about noises or things moving or that type of thing?
Yes. Yeah. And that would be the next most common for a residential is usually, you know, people are hearing, you know, footsteps, doors opening, doors closing, things like that. Lights turning on, lights turning off. A lot of things along those lines where people have something that's in their environment. And a lot of people choose to kind of live with that, but some people just kind of don't want it happening or they want some verification that they're not crazy and they would like us to kind of try and document that for them.
So what do? You come into the house and do what?
We'll come in and we'll set up. We use a lot of different equipment. We run on night security DVR system. We use a lot of different recording devices to record audio. Audio is usually the easiest thing to catch footsteps. A lot of EVP, which is electronic voice phenomena, which kind of the majority of our audios will come through very much as a whisper when you catch something that's not there.
Well, to that point, you know what? Let's take a listen, because you provided us with a bit of audio that gives an example of this. Let's take a listen to this. Okay, Daniel Mackin, what's going on here? What are we hearing?
Well, this is actually at, we did an investigation a few years ago at Ferris State in Big Rapids. And we investigated their old alumni building and the Pracken building. And I believe this was downstairs in the Pracken building. There was a room down there that some of the kids would kind of stay away from because the door would rattle and shake. And we had just had some activity in that room where we had heard a door slam. Even though we didn't physically see a door slam, we heard footsteps. I stepped out in the hallway to see if anyone was walking around out there. And this clip is actually an AVP, because it is an EVP, electronic voice phenomena. We caught it on our recorder, but I also heard this with my own ears. And as I stepped out there, I just heard somebody distinctly say, "Who are you?" And we kind of looked at it from the perspective of, you know, here we are. It's the middle of the night. We're in a place where, you know, we technically don't belong. We had been invited in, of course, but we don't belong there. So some authority figure that still lingers there, that still looks out for the place, was questioning why we were there in the middle of the night and what we were doing.
All right. So with that in mind, Mercedes, will you play that one more time so we can hear this? Who are you? Interesting. Interesting. Well, let me ask you this. If someone encounters paranormal activity, what should they do or not do? I mean, I guess I'm asking, is it dangerous in any way?
For us, you know, I've done so many cases over the last 11 to 12 years. We really don't encounter a lot that seems harmful. You know, I think, like, for us, 99.9% of what we encounter just kind of seems to be doing its own thing. Sometimes they will communicate with us. Sometimes they're kind of just going through and reliving the emotions of what they did in life. I don't usually run into cases where it's harmful, but we do run into cases, again, with children, where sometimes this entity or being will start to kind of tell them to do things, interact with them a little more. As far as if somebody runs into the paranormal, usually our best recommendation, if you don't want it around, just make that really clear. You draw a line in the sand that it is not welcome, that it does not need to be there, that you know, it's your environment now, and it's time for it to move on. And usually that, 9 times out of 10, is going to shut it down. You're not going to have any issues with it. Some people choose to live with their ghosts. It's almost like having an unusual family pet. Some people will just tell you stories about, oh, yeah, I heard my ghost last night. You know, he came up the stairs and he closed the door. So people react differently to it. And, you know, I wouldn't encourage seeking it out, because you can open it up to things that maybe you don't want to invite into your environment.
Daniel Mackin, I suspect if you had a nickel for every time somebody made some kind of Ghostbuster joke, Michigan Ghostbuster joke, you could retire rich. But what brought you to this whole area of investigating paranormal activity?
I used to kind of think that it was like, you know, the shows were all over TV, you know, Ghost Adventures, Ghost Hunters and stuff. And we were like, wow, this is really, really neat. But I started to track it back a little bit. I've kind of been working on a book, and I started to track it back and my interest in it. And I'm like, I started to go back a long ways to when I was 6 or 7 years old, and I was having encounters with paranormal activity at a very young age. And I kind of look back on it now, and I realize that I was kind of on this path for a long time, and I kind of just kind of found my way to it finally. So, but I always had a fascination with it, and I can kind of map my early years and through my teen years. And there was always just, you know, these little things that would happen that would kind of keep me going and kind of keep my interest in things that we can't see, and yet they seem to interact with us somehow.
Well, if this intrigues you, you can make plans this coming Sunday to attend the Mid-Michigan Paranormal Convention happening in Flint. And you say there are tickets available for those who want to come and explore this more?
Yes, there are still tickets available. That's at the Gateway Center in Flint, Michigan. I believe you can go right to their website, which is midmichiganparacon.com, and I think you can get tickets there.
Daniel Mackin, founder of MAPIT, the Michigan Area Paranormal Investigative Team. Thanks for sharing your work with us, Daniel.
Thank you, and happy Halloween.
And that's our show for today. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.